Okay, let's get into it. I've got material here that is enough for basically a semester of study on the topic of the Jubilee, a very important teaching from God's Word. And I've got 45 minutes to kind of give you just a little bit of a taste of something that I feel is very, very important. About 20 years ago, I started studying into the biblical Jubilee, which is mentioned in Leviticus 25, and its impact on society, certainly going forward into the world tomorrow. And it has really been a love of my life to study it, to just remember it and kind of observe our own world and understand how God is going to do certain things when it comes to the world tomorrow. And I really firmly, personally believe that God has given us a blueprint in His Jubilee for how He is going to restore all things. I think all of us recognize that we are in a very serious financial crisis right now in the United States. You would have to be living in a cave the last few weeks to not know that what has been taking place on Wall Street. Even yesterday, the Dow dropped over 700 points after coming roaring back over 900 points. And it's just been a roller coaster ride for the stock market and global financial markets around the world. It has been unprecedented. I think this has been going on for over a year now. If you remember, a year ago, last August, the subprime crisis began to make headlines and shake financial markets. And it rolled along for several months, and then back in March, Bear Stearns, one of the big financial houses on Wall Street, collapsed. And they thought perhaps things would be over at that point, but many financial experts realized that it really wasn't. And if you followed some of those, which I try to do at least to keep up with what's taking place, I don't pretend to understand every aspect of our financial world, but I try to understand and put it in a context and keep track of it, that they were saying that it just wasn't over. And then we got to this fall, and we've had our October surprise since the 1st of October. I don't know about you, but I do have a number of 401, I have a 401, 403B plan and a couple of IRAs for retirement, like many of you do. And with what's been taking place lately, instead of retiring at age 80, I'm now going to have to work till I'm 90 years of age with the way things have gone. With what happened last week, the experts say that it's going to take 5 years to just recover the losses of the first 2 weeks of October, if things would just even stable out and begin to build back at that point. So we have suffered what they are calling a global financial crisis. Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve Program, made a comment a few weeks ago, early September. He said that what is taking place is a once-in-a-generation, or actually a once-in-a-hundred-year problem. Once in a hundred years. Which is an interesting statement that he made, because if you understand, as I'm sure many of you do, that Jubilee is based on a 50-year cycle and an adjustment that takes place in society every 50 years, that's essentially once every 100 years or so. And so what we are seeing is indeed something that is of mammoth proportions. I'm not saying that we are on a 50-year cycle according to the biblical Jubilee. That's not what I'm saying. But world economies, world markets do have certain cyclical features about them. And we have been due for a shakeout, and we are getting it at this particular point in time. And it, who knows how far it's going to go. I am not an expert on the financial aspects of the stock market and the world global economy. As I say, I try to watch it and understand it. So basically, so I can, you know, we know how to kind of approach it editorially from our in our writings in World News and Prophecy and the Good News and other things that we do within the church, so that we keep a balanced perspective on it and don't go way out in our speculation, nor on the other hand just totally ignore things and keep our head in the sand. With what has taken place, this is something that I see, and I'll just speak personally for a moment as I try to understand it. I do feel that America's financial economy is not going to completely disappear. It is too important to the world economy, and there are too many other factors there. We are a very great economy and power economically in this world. In one sense, we're too big for the rest of the world to let us fall. But we've got our problems, and what began here is causing problems in the rest of the world. What I would be watching for, let's put it this way, is the rest of the world's reaction going forward over several months, perhaps even several years. I'm not going to try to guess that even. That they begin to react to make sure that they are no longer going to be impacted by what takes place in America and American form of capitalism. They've been caught with their pants down too, especially Europe. Their response to the crisis has lagged behind what America's response has been, even though both have not really kicked in fully yet as far as we can see. But I think that they're going to learn some lessons, Europe and the rest of the world, and they're not going to let themselves be tied to what has taken place in America going forward in the future. But on the other hand, having said that, America still is too great a power economically, politically, and even militarily to just completely ignore. We're not going to go away. We are not in the beginning of the crisis at the end of the close of the age. I'm not even trying to say that or think that, so please don't extrapolate that forward by what I say. We are in a very serious situation. Certainly a recession is going to take place, and we certainly pray that we do not enter into a depression. None of us want to see that. But it is, for our own times and in our lifetime, it is unprecedented what has taken place, and it is very serious. So I think we do need to be aware of it. We do need to be praying about it, certainly for the welfare of, all peoples, but as well for the work of God, that it can be able to continue to do its job, and I think that it still has a job to do. So I look for things to stabilize and to turn around in time. And then I have a personal stake in it as well. As I say, I don't want to work to age 90. So as some of you have, many of you have a personal stake in it as well. But we've seen the names of Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley and Wachovia all change, and the entire financial structure of our society take quite a beating in recent days. And it has just created a great deal of change. All right, enough of the bad news of the present. Let's try to focus our mind on the future. In Acts chapter 3 and in verse 21, there is a key statement that Mr. Armstrong used to say was kind of the benchmark verse of the Bible, Acts 3 and verse 21, that talks of Jesus Christ, whom heaven must receive until the times of restoration of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. The Bible story points to the time when all things will be restored. All aspects of God's way of life will be restored to this world. And how that will be done, and on what pattern, and as I said earlier, what blueprint, sometimes I think we can look into the Bible and begin to understand how God will do that. 20 years ago, as I mentioned, I began a personal study into the concept of the Jubilee, the biblical Jubilee, and came to a personal feeling that we could very well be looking at a general blueprint that God has laid there, laid out for ancient Israel, and is something that we can look at and study and see as a means by which God will do this restoration of all things in the world to come, the world tomorrow. God does not operate without a plan, without a purpose. We understand that through the holy days and other aspects, and the details of God's plan and purpose have been worked out from the foundation of the world. Not just the sacrifice of the Lamb, but all aspects of it. God knows what he is doing, and I think that he has left us with some understanding to begin to appreciate his mind and his will and his purpose in restoring the world to the beauty, to the picture that the scriptures in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Micah and Zechariah describe of a world restored to peace, to prosperity, and to the beauty and to the images that we put into our mind when we come to the Feast of Tabernacles and we think about the millennium and the kingdom of God on this earth and the beauty and the world as it will be. It is going to be a remarkable time. And again, we can conjure up all forms of images in our hearts to appreciate that, understand it, and we tend to do that at this particular time of year, and that is as it should be, to appreciate what this world will eventually come to. In Zechariah chapter 3 and in verse 10, it says that everyone during this period will invite his neighbor under his vine and under his fig tree. Again, a picture of abundance, a picture of peace, and of settled communities, families intact. peace and the relationships between people. Everyone under his vine and under his fig tree in a setting that produces tranquility and peace. Many of the scriptures that talk about the millennium are really in an agricultural setting of abundance and beauty, of that we can picture in some of our best images from America's heartland. And again, those things can help us to appreciate what God has done and certainly will do, even from the scale that we have in our own development in our own world today. Other scriptures talk about the time when the deserts will bloom. So land is going to be a time when land will be recovered. And we have vast parts of the world today that are uninhabitable. Some parts, especially in Israel, if you go to Israel today, this is a scene from some of the work that they have done in Israel to reclaim the desert land. Literally, the Israelis have pioneered agricultural techniques that have turned the deserts into productive arid areas of productivity. You see that in these banana trees or date palms that these are right next to right in the midst of a desert scene. I've made a couple of trips to Israel the last few years, and you see these all over the place. So they have done a great deal to, in their own way, fulfill this particular verse physically right now, but the scriptures tell us that God is going to do that far more into the future to reclaim the land of this earth for the populations that will not only survive over into the world tomorrow, but will be born during that time and will develop in regard to the families of the earth and of all the nations that we read about in all of these scriptures. Now, that restoration and reclamation project is going to be massive. Years ago, we had a booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, and there was an attempt made editorially to try to go through and explain how that would be. And some of you will even remember a kind of a mock newspaper that we drew up to go along with that, that had banner headlines and articles about the world tomorrow and the reclamations and the economic systems that would be in place. Some of you may still have that tucked away somewhere within your archives. And we try to project ourselves through the scriptures into the future to see what this job would be like. This one particular passage of scripture in Leviticus 25, and if you can go ahead and turn there, we're going to go through it. I'm not going to put the scriptures on the screen. This is the interactive part of the presentation here today for you to follow along with and in your Bible. In Leviticus chapter 25, in one succinct chapter, we have a description of the Jubilee. This is the only place really in the Bible where it's discussed. We don't have any other specific mention of it in the scriptures except in Luke chapter 4 where Jesus went in and talked about the sermon that he did in the synagogue of Nazareth. There is a connection there to the Jubilee, and we can go to other scriptures and see certain elements of the Jubilee within certain actions that we see in scriptures. We have no record in the Bible of Israel ever keeping a Jubilee. We don't know that that ever happened. Certainly from the Bible there is not this. But this is the most intact record that we have of a system that God gave regarding a 50-year cycle of economic and social development within the land. And we'll just be able to touch the high points of this, so let's jump into it and stay with me here. In verses 1 through 7, it talks about the seven-year land rest and return after 7 years, where it says in verse 3, 6 years you will sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard, but in the seventh year there will be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You'll neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. This was a principle that God put in place that every 7 years there would be a land rest system. The seventh year would be a rest for the land. Elements of this particular law also allowed for debt release during that time as well. You read about it in more detail back in Deuteronomy 16. In Exodus chapter 21, 22, there are elements of it that are referenced as well. And that was an ongoing system of the land rest for the land. It is in verse 8 that we begin to get into the concept of the Jubilee. Because here he says, you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years. That's 49 years. 7 times 7. for yourself 7 times 7 years. And the time of the seven Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then, in that 49th year, you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all of its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession. And each of you shall return to his family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of your intended vine. It is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You will eat its produce from the field. In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession. And then it goes on to give a few more details regarding this. In verse 17 it says, therefore you shall not oppress one another, and you shall fear your Lord, your God, for I am the Lord, your God. So you went through every 7 years a year of rest or year of release on the land. And after 7 cycles of that, you came to the 49th year, and you still had in that 49th year your year of rest. And then, according to the idea of the Jubilee, that there was the 50th year, or the following year from the 49th, would be the Jubilee year. And it began on the Day of Atonement with the sounding of a trumpet, especially at that time. So what you wind up with during this period of time are essentially 2 years of the land being at rest. Now, it's a remarkable test of faith in an agricultural society to let your land rest 1 year and not harvest it and take only what was growing of itself, as the law allowed, but not plan a harvest for 1 year and then begin the eighth year to go through your harvest cycles. As we all would recognize, that would be a test of faith in God and a remarkable event. To do that 2 years in a row, once in a century, let's say, or once every 50 years, in the 49th and the 50th year, would be a double test of faith. God, through the word, his promise here, made the promise that he would provide for the people at that time. But that is the case of what is taking place. Now, we've begun to read primarily from verse 13 forward, and on through verse 34, we find various elements of the Jubilee year here as it is dealing with the ownership of property and the provisions that would be made. Verse 18, it says, you'll observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them and dwell in the land in safety. So God would promise safety, national security along with this. He says, the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety. And if you say, what shall we eat in the 7th year, since we shall not sow nor gather in our produce? I will command my blessing on you in the 6th year, and it will bring produce enough for 3 years. A specific promise from God. So that 48th year would be an abundance, a triple abundance of productivity that would be allowed to be stored up. If Joseph stored up for the Egyptians 7 years worth of food, it's not inconceivable that 3 years could be stored up under a managed economic system within the land that would be preparing for this. Verse 23 picks up another concept. The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers. And in all the land of your possession you shall grant, and in your land of possession you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possessions, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, he may redeem what his brother has sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale, and restore the remainder to the man whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. He goes on to give a specific instruction there. He said in verse 28, if he's not able to have it restored to himself, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee. And in the Jubilee it shall be released and returned, and he shall return to his possession. What you essentially have described here is that every 50 years, ownership of the land reverts back to the original owners. If for some reason, through bankruptcy, through debt, or any other social reason or cause that land would be sold on the 20th year or on the 28th year or whatever, that was allowed. But what everyone knew was that by the 50th year, that land was going to revert back to the original owners, and the entire economy of the land or the nation would be, in essence, reset. So the ownership of the land was something that stayed within a particular family or a particular tribe, if you will, as a family would grow larger, clan, if you want to use that term. And it was something that would be meant to stay there. And it goes on to talk about the distinctions between rural land and land in the city. Verse 29 talks about land in the city had a different distinction given to it and the way that it was treated. Verse 33, if a man purchased a house from the Levites, the house that he was sold in the city or his possession will be released in the Jubilee, for the houses in the cities of the Levites are their possessions among the children of Israel. But the field of the common land of their cities will be sold, for it is their perpetual possession. If one of your brethren becomes poor. Now here, beginning in verse 35, we begin to see the way by which money is dealt with and how people are handled if at times they fall into poverty. If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you, and take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You will not lend to him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. One of the things God repeatedly mentions throughout this law is that the land belongs to him and the people belong to him. And when you adopt that approach, how you deal with land and things and how you deal with people become very, very important. They become central to an ethic and to the entire society. One of the things about this law of the Jubilee is that there is really embedded in here an entire sociology of a people, of a land, of a nation, of a culture, a sociology that governs not just economics, but families, family relations, marriages, child rearing, welfare, how people deal with one another, how they live in their families, in their cities, in their communities. All of it is governed and dealt with and touched by this particular law. That's why I say it is really something that it would be a whole semester of study, perhaps, to go through. It would be interesting if at some point in our Ambassador Bible Center we had a whole semester that would allow the study in detail of the sociology of the Jubilee and show from the entire Bible an integrated system that I think can be shown as to how a society would work if it were built upon God's way of life and this particular law in general. But God is very specific to remind throughout this as to how you deal with people. He goes on in verse 39 to talk about the dealing with people. He says, if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he'll be with you and shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, he and his children with him, and he shall return to his own family. He shall return to the possession of his fathers. So if a person went bankrupt, could not handle their finances, the system that God placed originally to work within Israel was a very humane system by which a person could then be protected. And really, when you study the laws on this, you go back to Exodus and you study the laws, you see that the entire family actually went into this protective type of servitude. The scripture, I know, that uses the word slavery. Try to get our modern use of that word out of our mind, because that's not what God is talking about here when he uses the word slavery. There's an indenture or an indebtedness here that is implied, that is really is what it's talking about. And it's not so much the idea that we have more in our modern world of slavery where one person owns another person as we have had it in the American experience of slavery or other cultures, Britain, for instance, that we most know about. This is something completely different as God placed it within Israel. And specifically within this law, you will find that the entire family went into a kind of a protective system where they were provided for, and whoever this quote owned them or was the holding their note of debt had the responsibility to educate and rehabilitate them and give them the opportunity to leave that situation after a given number of times of years if they had learned the lesson. And if through, let's say, the lifetime of the one responsible, let's say a father, made a bad judgment, bad decision, if through his lifetime it wasn't learned, his children had the opportunity to learn from that and not be forever tied to the mistakes of his father, and could eventually look forward to a time of release, either through the 7 year or even more so on the 50th year with even the land returning back to them, and another opportunity would be given for the family to get it right. And you see this would move through the generations, and it would give a sense of hope. It would give a sense of opportunity that would be real opportunity for people to learn from the mistakes of the past and to make a better life within their generation or for the next generation, guaranteed within the law. This is what we see as we go through here and look at this system. Again, in verse 42, he says, "They are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves." Again, God looked at his people as his. And when you look at someone else as God's heritage, again, that begins to dictate how we relate to them, how we treat them. We recognize that we all belong to God. We are all children of God. And when you begin to economically and socially interact from that perspective, it changes things completely in the way matters are worked. This particular part goes all the way down here in verse 25 through the down to verse 55, the remainder of the chapter, in a particular law about slavery that talks about even how a person's services would be arranged and worked with. Verse 47 says, if a sojourner or a stranger close to you becomes rich and one of your brethren dwells by him and becomes poor and sells himself to a stranger or to a member of the stranger's family, after he's sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one who is near of kin to him in his family may redeem him. If he's able, he may redeem himself. Thus he shall reckon with him who brought him. The price of his release shall be according to the number of years from the year he was sold to him until the year of Jubilee. It shall be according to the times of a hired servant. If there are still many years remaining, according to them, he shall repay the price of his redemption from the money which he was bought. And if there remain but a few years until the year of Jubilee, then he shall reckon with him according to his years. He shall repay him the price of his redemption. You see right in there a very interesting economic principle that not only applied to the services of an individual, but also to the land. Earlier, the same principle was mentioned in regard to the land itself. If a piece of land was sold, or if a person went into indentureship, economic slavery to another, let's say with 25 years to go until the Jubilee, the price of that land, the price of the service of that individual was dictated according to the number of years remaining to the Jubilee. If there were more years to the Jubilee, then there was a bigger price for the piece of land. If there were only 5 years to the Jubilee, then it would not be as expensive as if there were more, because everyone would know that at the 50th year, the people were going to be set free and the land was going to revert back to its owner. What that did is interesting, or would do. If you had an economic system set up on a 50-year cycle and you knew how things were going to come to pass at the end of 50 years, and you were pricing your goods, your land, and what the land developed during that time on that basis, you would have a set price year by year that you could then make your decisions on that you knew was going to be accurate. what was, if 30 years were left to the Jubilee, you knew the value. If 10 years were left to the Jubilee, you knew the value. That creates a stability within society. I mention that with emphasis because what we are dealing with right now in this financial crisis, in part, is being caused because the banks do not know the value of the assets that they are holding, and therefore they will not loan to one another. The whole credit system is locked up. And it's the same thing that happened during the Great Depression. It was one of the final straws that put the country into a depression, is because nobody could value the assets that someone else had. And that's what we are dealing with today, in large part, has been a prime cause of this. You've seen the subprime loans and the price of housing and land go down, where it was probably overinflated in some areas of the country, and loans were made on that basis, repackaged, sold on down the line. You know that, some of you know that story. And that to where the end holder didn't know what he was holding, or the value of what he was holding. Everyone had these massive assets, and nobody knew the value of them. And they were sinking and declining, and what was on the books was not worth as much. And these banks and these financial houses have gone under as a result when nobody could determine the value of the assets. That happened in the 1930s. In the Jubilee system, you would know the value of the assets based upon the number of years to the Jubilee. That's what's embedded in the law. And that one point alone would go a long way toward evening out and stabilizing the economic aspect of a society to where there was equity and there was stability within the system. So it's a remarkable concept to stop and to think about and to appreciate in the whole scheme of things when you look at many of the details of this chapter. I've skimmed over it. We can't go through all of it in detail to show it all, but I want to bring you back to what it does talk about in terms of the three different aspects. If we can talk about this here for a minute, the Jubilee Law really deals with three concepts. Number one is property ownership, the land. Okay? How many of you recognize this picture? Anybody recognize what this picture is? There's a little bit of movie trivia. How many of you know what this scene is from? Gone with the Wind. There's Father O'Hara, and there's Katie Scarlett. You remember the line that he said to her in this particular scene as they were looking out over Tara? He said, "It's the land, Katie Scarlett. It's the land." I know you saw that. I don't do it as well as he did. But he was making a point. The basis of wealth is the land. The basis of wealth for any people, any nation, any society is the land. And this law deals with the land. Who owns the land? God owns the land. But when he apportions it, and I think that he will apportion it in the world tomorrow, it is going to be apportioned in principle according to this law, and it is going to remain within a family, within a tribe, within a group. The basis of wealth is land. Some of you are from Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia. I lived down in Pikeville area years ago for a couple of years, and one of the things I noticed when I got there was how much of that land was owned by large holding companies in Philadelphia and Washington and New York and Boston, who had gone down in about 100 or more years ago and bought up all the mineral rights, all the coal rights of that land. And hundreds of thousands of acres were owned by companies far off, because it was sold for a pittance by the people who were on the land at the time. The wealth of the land in that part of the world lies underneath the coal. And in other parts of the world, it's oil or something else. But it is from the land that a nation gains its wealth. And we have been blessed in this country with a great deal of that. And this law of the Jubilee deals with that and protects that, so that a society is stabilized throughout. It also is a law and a principle that deals with money. Under God's law, anyone who mismanaged his money, had a chance to recover. He could learn from his mistake. Now, I know we have bankruptcy laws in America, and they've had to be reformed through the years because they don't always work right, and they're rather stringent right now. But when you study into the laws that God placed to have been within Israel, they would help a person learn from his mistake, and the poverty would not be generational, would not be passed on from generation to generation. God also teaches that the lending of money among yourselves is an act of charity. Don't charge interest. That's embedded within the law as well. Interest was allowed on capital speculation, but not when it came down to a matter of to your brother. That was meant to be a matter of service. Thirdly, the Jubilee law deals with people, how we deal with people, how we look to people. As I've already mentioned, it would better be a term instead of slavery, indebtedness or servitude in that sense. It was a different relationship. You know, when you really study into the law as God intended it, you will even find that the slave in time would have the opportunity, if he was faithful and there was not an heir, he could inherit his owner's or his master's property. Remember the case of Abraham. He didn't have a son. And his servant Eliezer was in line to inherit what he had. Within God's system, there was a very equitable, humane structure that allowed people to develop according to their skills and their abilities. And it was not the harsh, onerous system that we've come to understand historically. So the way people were dealt with, because as God said, I brought them out of slavery. I own them. You treat each other right in every aspect of the society, and it will go well. Now, let's look at some of the practical effects of the Jubilee. It would eliminate extremes of wealth. You would not have a lot of wealth concentrated in a very small percentage of the population, and large middle classes, and even larger underclasses, which is what we can see in many different ways around the world today. It eliminates extremes of wealth and poverty, and that would eliminate the establishment of a class society. You would have a true system of equality created. Man's efforts have not been able to accomplish that yet. They emphasize giving, the law of giving, throughout all facets of society. We used to talk about the fact that God's way of life is a way of give. And this law has that permeating every aspect of the specific regulations of this particular law throughout all aspects of society. It would promote racial harmony. The Jubilee promotes racial harmony. With this type of system in place, racial strife will end. In the world tomorrow, the law of the Jubilee is going to prevent, in a practical sense, racial strife and the causes of it. Each people, all nations will have their land. And as we can see from other scriptures, that land is going to be changed completely different than what we have today. There's going to be even a restructuring of the deserts and the mountains and so much of this earth today. No one group is going to be imported forcibly or through economic need to another land to fulfill any other nation's interests, because they're going to have what they need in their own area and be able to develop to their fullest potential in their own area. That alone, if we understand it, would solve a lot of the modern problems we have in various countries of the world, where peoples have had to be either forcibly enslaved and transported to another land, or because of economic situation, migrate to other lands, which is still a matter that goes on in the world today, and work in another part of the world and suffer because they are not of the same ethnicity or race of the home people. So this law would create a practical means for racial harmony that would be lasting. It would also preserve the home and the family, guaranteeing the means of financial independence and security. As I've already talked about, if a person made a mistake financially, there was an opportunity for either within that generation or the next generation to recover. A land that people would have would also be able to be preserved, and the encouragement would be to preserve land and to develop it for the next generation, knowing it's going to be passed on. You develop that land. You talk about going green, and that's so much of a buzzword today in terms of pollution, and everything's got to be green. Green is built into the law of the Jubilee, because you're going to preserve that land ecologically in every way, knowing that it's going to be something that's going to be passed on to your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, and you're not going to abuse it in any way, shape, or form. So there's so many different aspects by which people can carry on the family business and the interests of the land as it is passed from generation to generation. The law teaches that God owns everything. God owns all, as I've said. He owns the people. He owns the land. You approach it from that particular perspective, and then you know how to deal with private property and the stewardship of land, and you recognize that people's services are only, in a sense, on loan. The land is owned by God, and you recognize that, and you treat it in that particular way as it comes from God. It teaches you to honor God and to serve man, to use your physical, material wealth to honor God and to serve one another, not to pile it all up for yourself, Scrooge-like, or in some other way to be selfishly consumed only upon you. It helps teaches us truly how to manage what we have been given, to honor God and to serve man. And coming on the Day of Atonement, as it does, the Jubilee teaches, perhaps as much as anything else, will teach people the concept of mercy and to deal mercifully with one another within the land and within the system. It's an amazing part of life. What can we apply? How do we apply this today? The church has no means to enforce the Jubilee. As I said, we have no record from the Bible of it ever really being done within the land of Israel. We can't even point historically to any way that it is done. But the Jubilee, folks, if we stop and think about it and apply ourselves to understand its broadest principles, it teaches us how to deal with things. Okay, number one. How to deal with things. How to deal with money, land, and people. Not just how to win at Monopoly. But it teaches us how to deal with things. God says in Leviticus 25 and verse 23, "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me." Secondly, it teaches us how to deal with people. The Jubilee law teaches us how to deal with people. Again, verse 55 of Leviticus 25 says that the children of Israel are servants to me. They are servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. The land and the people literally belong to God, and we should deal with each other kindly as a result. Sometimes we might legitimately ask, will this work? Is it really practical? This is just an outline. God will fill in a lot of the details. In a society that is built in the world tomorrow, I don't think that it is going to be completely an agriculturally based society. I think that it will be a modern world in every sense of the word when we get there, and this law will be adapted and applied to all aspects of a developing, growing society throughout that thousand-year period. But the fundamental principles are here to build upon, and I think God gives us a blueprint. Does it work? I think it does. Let me leave you with one example from the Scriptures of where God's law, God's way of life, was followed in what might seem like a small part. You all remember the story of Ruth, where Ruth was redeemed by Boaz, the nearest kinsman. The last chapter of Ruth. And this older gentleman, Boaz, did what was right according to the law of God, which was, again, part of this overall social structure. He redeemed his relative's wife. He did what was right. Now, that's a very nice story we read every once in a while. Sometimes we read it on Pentecost. But when you understand the breadth of that decision made by Boaz to do what was right, you realize that from Boaz and his marriage to Ruth came a king named David a few generations later. And then from that point on, another several generations forward, came another king, the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. When people make the right decisions to do it God's way, even in what might seem like the smallest details of a social arrangement, it works, and it works through the generations. Imagine an entire society fulfilling every aspect of the Word of God, the way of God, in our dealings with one another and things and the land, and then imagine the peace, the productivity, the prosperity of the world to come. And you will understand a little bit and begin to appreciate how that is going to take place.